have the strongest economy in the world.
A second quarter GDP, 1.2%.
GDP has taken a step downward the last three quarters.
Now, I don't think President Obama and Vice President Biden get the credit they deserve for saving us from the worst economic crisis of our lifetime.
If you listen to that speech last night, it was almost schizophrenic. Half of it said, oh, President Obama left us a great economy. This country's great. The economy's great.
But none of us can be satisfied with the status quo. Not by a long shot.
The other half said, well, people are hurting real bad.
We will work with both parties to pass the biggest investment in new good-paying jobs since World War II.
Investment is code for stimulus and government spending, good-paying jobs since World War II. They believe that the government creates jobs, not private businesses.
All of these investments, we're going to pay for every single one of them. And here's how. Wall Street, corporations, and the super rich are going to start paying their fair share of taxes.
The corporations are not owned by fugitive Nazi war criminals in Paraguay. They're owned by American citizens saving for their retirement.
No matter how good they say it is, it's not. It's, I mean, people can hack it, I guess. I mean, it's just terrible.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, a surprising number on GDP that kind of shocked the markets on Friday. Everybody was predicting 2.6% economic growth for the second quarter. Instead, a disappointing 1.2%. That's already changing the futures market on expected Fed rate hikes. They were expected with better looking numbers that the Fed could go as soon as September. Well, after today's second quarter number, throw that out the window. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava. Welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up in the first hour, Tom McClellan, he thinks basically sideways market, and then we go down hard into the fall with the market bottoming sometime in September and October. You're going to want to hear what he has to say coming out of that. Tom McClellan will be joining me in hour one. Chris Sheridan will be here to talk about what moved the markets this week. And Frank Holmes will be here to talk about gold, why he's never been this bullish. All of that coming up in hour one.
And I'm John Loeffler. You know, we keep talking about moving down into a recession next year, but what we do know is coming is there's another financial crisis on the way. It's just a question of how soon it's going to get here, although it will most likely arrive during the presidency of whomever is elected in November. And of course, that has real political implications. Remember that everything is a confidence game, a game to keep the whole thing going and to oftentimes keep the public deceived or off balance as to what is actually going on, convinced that everybody is in control. Of course, the numbers that came out this week didn't show that, where economic growth was just a little bit over 1% when the Fed itself was projecting 2.5%. If you notice, they always get it wrong. Why are you listening to them anymore? I don't know. So that's the first part of the big picture we'll discuss today here on the program. Deflation moving to inflation. We've been in a disinflationary environment for 35 years, but trends do not last forever. And how long will this trend last? And since helicopter money seems to be on the horizon here from central banks, what does that mean in investors? How do you live in a constantly switching risk off, risk on, risk off, risk on, which it's almost risque type of environment.
That's the first time I've ever heard it put that way, John. You should go on CNBC and become a financial announcer.
Yes, we've actually started, you know, on our website, we've actually started a lexicon of my terms so that people can look them up.
What's one of my favorite words? Flabbergastative.
Flabbergastative, right. Capable of causing extreme nausea. Flabbergastative.
Oh, okay. Flabbergastative. Okay.
So anyway, lots of flabbergastative risque coming up today on the big picture here on the Financial Sense News Hour. And as we usually do on the program, we hear from Ryan Poplava, but surprise, surprise, we're not going to do that this week. Chris Sheridan is sitting in Ryan's stead. Ryan is not feeling too well, and Chris hosts most of our weekly premium podcast during the week. So if we had to look at the markets, what would you say the events were this week that warrant our attention?
U.S. markets really held up their gains from the new all-time highs that we saw after the Brexit rout. If we go back just a little bit, we'll remember late June, U.K. citizens voted to leave the EU and markets plunged around the globe anywhere from around 5 to 10%. But as quickly as they plunged, they then turned around and went almost straight up into new all-time highs. And this week, markets held up at those levels. So to the surprise of many, we are maintaining so far the record highs in the stock market, and there hasn't been a pullback, though many people are really thinking that we are due for one. Of course, people have been saying that for a long time. We've been due for a pullback for the past few years or more. But at this point, you know, I think from the February lows, we're up something like 20%. So a phenomenal move. So really, it's a question of whether or not we're going to see some of the seasonal weakness that we typically see from this August, September to October timeframe. There was a chart that I just posted to our Twitter page provided by Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, and it shows that if we look at the three-month period, August to October, that is when returns are definitely lowest for the S&P 500, and that data goes back to 1928. So we tend to see these major drawdowns come in this three-month time period that we're coming up to right now. And I think a lot of people are wondering, hey, we've seen such a big rally. Are we going to see a pause and a pullback? If so, how much? So that's one thing that a lot of traders are probably looking at. However, there is another possible tailwind that is being cited, and that's the fact that we're moving out of the blackout period for buybacks. And so around earnings season, we see a blackout period where companies can't go in and buy their stocks. We are now moving out of that blackout period, and a large majority of S&P 500 companies will now, when we head into August, be able to buy back their shares. And of course, that has been a major driver for the stock market. If you've been listening to this program for some time, you'll know that really what we see taking place is as yields head lower and lower in government debt, a lot of global investors, as we spoke about with David Marsh at the OMFIF, many of these global public investors, including central banks, public pension funds, sovereign wealth funds, you know, they have on the magnitude of $30 trillion of investable funds that they need to find some type of decent return. And so they're diversifying out of government debt and they're going into corporate bonds. They're going into equities. As we saw on Friday, the Bank of Japan is buying more of their equities. So that's really been a major driver, is you see a lot of funds being poured into corporate bonds, AA rated, AAA rated corporate debt. Apple had just sold a lot of corporate debt. I believe it was on the order of $7 billion. And then they're going in and buying back their own shares, which is keeping their stock price up. So that is obviously an ongoing trend that we see taking place. So when we look forward at the month of August, that is going to be a possible tailwind, even if we do see some seasonal weakness in this August to October timeframe. It'll be a really key thing to watch and see how many of these corporations are going in and buying back their stock, what the rates are there, because if we see them start to pull back on their buybacks, then that could mean that we don't have as much of a support there. So, you know, we have headwinds and we have tailwinds. We're going to have to watch and see how those balance out. As I mentioned, there was a big announcement on Friday with the Bank of Japan. And so this was a very widely anticipated meeting. Many had been saying that we were going to see some form of helicopter drops by the BOJ. We're not quite there yet. And many are saying that their policy response underwhelmed, that the helicopters are not en route to Japan. So that is giving investors a little bit of a pause. Another thing that we saw this week was oil prices continued to fall, and we're now down into the lower 40 region. If you look at the WTI, that's the West Texas Intermediate Crude contract that's here in the U.S. So we're back down from the highs. I believe we're now officially in a bear market. We've come off 20% from the June highs. So oil has rolled over And lastly, another big report that we saw on Friday was for the second quarter GDP. There was a big miss there, and it came in at 1.2%, half of what most economists expected. And GDP growth was also revised down to 0.8% in the first quarter from 1.1%. And growth was also revised down for the fourth quarter of 2015 to 0.9% from 1.4%. So not only did we see a big disappointment for the second quarter, but we also saw downward revisions for the prior quarters as well. And Brian Shatkin at the conference board said that the growth trend of the American economy seems on a path of dropping off significantly from its assumed 2% growth trend. And we just posted an article on Financial Sense. If you'd like to take a look at some of the data that we're looking at currently, if we step back and look at the big picture, really what's been driving U.S. economic growth the past few quarters has been consumer spending. So the U.S. consumer is really what's holding up the economy right now. If you look, business investment is in the doldrums, getting worse. Net exports are just marginally positive, and government spending, government outlays are basically flat to negative. So really, when it comes down to the components that economists use to measure GDP, it really comes down to the consumer at this point. And so the question then becomes, how sustainable is the U.S. economy if it's all on the backs of the U.S. consumer? And one of the main pillars that we need to look at is the growth of wages and salaries. And unfortunately, we also see that for the first half of 2016, wages and salaries have now come in at the weakest level in 3 years, and there were also downward revisions on that data as well. So far, it does not appear like we're seeing a massive pickup in wages and salaries. So if that trend continues, that is, if businesses which are not investing in capital equipment, they're not investing in R&D, if they also stop investing in employees, it appears that they haven't for the first half of this year, at least. But if they also decide, now we're going to need to cut back on hiring and eventually moving into layoffs, that's the really big worry that a lot of people are kind of focusing on. And of course, one of the best ways to gauge whether or not we're seeing that is when we look at U.S. jobless claims. So if you look at the piece that we just posted on Friday, it's titled Big Miss on U.S. GDP, What to Watch If Things Are Heading South. We show a chart of U.S. initial jobless claims. We haven't seen jobless claims tick up yet, and that tends to happen right before a recession. However, it appears they're in a process of bottoming and are about where we've seen a pickup in the past. So that's going to be a really important indicator that we're going to want to watch and monitor to see if the U.S. expansion is really coming to an end. In agreement with what Brian Shatkin at the conference board said earlier about the growth trend of the American economy seemingly being on a path of dropping off significantly from its 2% growth trend, one way we can look at this as well is at a chart of the conference board's leading economic index, and we prefer to look at that on a year-over-year growth rate. That is now at 0.7, the lowest rate that we've seen during this entire economic expansion after the recovery took hold. So if that starts to turn negative, that is also going to be a red flag. And lastly, another important indicator that we can watch is the Philly Fed State Coincident Index. The most recent data point came out for that, I believe it was this week, and that showed a very steep plunge. That's a chart that you're going to want to look at. That has timed tops in the market quite well, and it's also very timely when we want to gauge the risk of a recession in the U.S., as it tends to fall prior to recessions. The most recent data point, like I said, it has experienced a steep plunge. So we'll want to see if whether or not that is some type of anomaly or if it is substantiated by some of the other measures that I mentioned already, including the Philly Fed leading index, which is going to be updated next week. So if we see a steep drop in the Philly Fed leading index, perhaps as early as next week or in the months ahead in subsequent releases, that's certainly going to be a major red flag as well. So these are some of the things that we're tracking here on our show. I definitely would recommend that you take a look at those charts to see how they correspond to the ebbs and flow of both the market and the economy in the past, because these are very useful indicators that all of us can use.
All right, Chris Yardon, I appreciate you sitting in this week for Ryan Poplavin. Good weekend.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
If you're approaching retirement age or concerned about making plans for those retired years and having adequate income, you're going to want to hear our Lifetime Income series every Monday and Tuesday here at FinancialSense.com. Right now, here's a preview of this week's Lifetime Income program.
Joining me on the program is Professor Wade Pfau from American University. And Wade, you and I were just talking prior to going on the air. There's been a number of articles that have come out recently, one in Bloomberg and also one in the Wall Street Journal. The one in the Wall Street Journal talked about these retirement calculators. I mean, you just Google retirement and you can find all kinds of calculators out there. There's robo planners. Let's talk about what these calculators actually do, because as the Wall Street Journal talked about, they really should be a starting point for a conversation. They shouldn't be the be-all to end-all. In other words, you plug a number in and it says that's the number. That may not necessarily be the case when you actually get to retirement. So let's talk about these programs.
Yeah, I mean, there was a study last year from Texas Tech University that they ran a case study for an individual through, I think, 36 different online retirement calculators. And naturally, they got 36 different answers, but it was all over the place. Some calculators said, you know, basically they're on track for a very successful retirement. Others said they're way off track. And it's a matter of the assumptions going into that, and it's a matter of just how the question is framed. I do question the way a lot of what quote-unquote traditional retirement planning is focused on, which is trying to meet some sort of retirement wealth target and to say that, well, if I determine I need to have $2 million and that's when I can retire, I think in practice things really don't work so easily, and there's a lot more to the story than that. But that's really how a lot of the retirement calculators tend to function.
Well, after a nice run-up since early July, the stock market has been pulling back lately. Is this just a small correction on an upward trajectory, or is there something else going on here? Joining us on the program is Tom McClellan. And Tom, let's begin with one of the oldest technical theories of the market, and that's Dow theory. You've got the industrials that have hit an all-time record high, but when you look at the transports are non-confirming. Now, is that something that should be taken seriously, or do you think this is something that will eventually normalize itself and the transports will confirm what we're seeing in the Dow?
It is something that should be taken seriously, but people need to know it's a little bit deeper of a question than just industrials or transports. Back when Charles Dow first postulated that idea of looking at the difference between those two indices, the transport index was entirely a rail index, which made sense. You had the industrials making stuff and you had the rail companies moving stuff. It was all about stuff. Now, the transportation average is made up of a lot of airlines that don't so much move stuff as they move people's tuchuses around the sky to go to Puerto Vallarta. And that's really not as much of an indication of the strength of the economy as it is to be moving freight and cargo and coal and wheat and things around the rail. If we had a pure rail index these days, or maybe a rail plus ocean shipping index, that might be a better equivalent to what Charles Dow did. But the current transportation average is contaminated a little bit by the inclusion of the airline. That said, it still can be worth looking at, and it's not a positive message to have the transportation average not confirming the higher highs that we've seen in the Dow and the S&P.
Yeah, because one thing, if we take this fact that the transports now include airlines, well, that signals to me something is awry with the economy, because if you have the fuel cost that are down tremendously, there's a glut of gasoline on the market. You've seen oil prices go from 100 down to 26. So one of the main costs of running an airline today, besides labor, has been fuel costs. That's down tremendously. So you would think that with lower fuel costs, the airlines should be doing extremely well, because one of their costs have gone down significantly. So if the airlines aren't doing well, That's telling me that either people aren't moving around as much, they're not traveling, or something's going on in the economy if they're not doing well.
It's true that oil costs are down quite a bit from 2 to 3 years ago, but they've doubled since the bottom at $25 a barrel. And so I think that the more recent response in the airline stocks is to the doubling of crude oil off of the bottom, not the memory of what it was like 3 years ago. We humans have the weakness of remembering the recent past more strongly than the more distant past and thinking that the more recent past is what's going to persist. Airlines also have the cost of trying to get new space at a terminal, and there's other costs. But yes, you're right that fuel cost is the big one, and that's the one that they respond to most. If we do get the drop in oil prices that the gasoline glut right now seems to indicate, and that there's a glut of oil storage too, then that should put downward pressure on oil prices if what we all learned in Econ 101 is still true.
So when we take a look at this, we've seen, Tom, various trades over the last year. Last year, it was the FANG stock, so the market was willing to pay an extra premium for any company that could show above trend economic growth or revenue growth like Facebook or Amazon or these stocks. This year, you've had the stub trade, which is staples, telecoms, utilities, and bonds. So what does that tell you about the nature of this market in terms of what's doing well and what's not?
Well, the trade that everybody wants to crowd into is the one that I get fearful about. Whenever the crowd comes to a consensus conclusion about anything, I want to be heading the other way. So, yeah, the bank trade was great when we had 0% short-term rates and they could loan out longer-term for positive rates. But that's gone away now, too, because even in Europe, I think most of Switzerland's debt is now negative. It's an incredible time that we're living in, and it's not going to be a long-lasting time because we're in the upward phase of the 60-year interest rate cycle. That cycle ideally bottomed in 2010, but we've had a much broader bottom, which is typical of the last 250 years or so that the interest rate cycle has been in operation. Interest rates should be headed up toward their next peak in 2040, and so it won't be in a straight line. But the last 60-year peak was 1980, and you probably remember 17% mortgage rates back in 1980. We're headed toward the next cycle peak in 2040, and we're starting from zero interest rates. So they've got a lot of ground to make up to get back to some kind of high. I'm not saying we're going back to 17% mortgage rates in 2040, but that cycle's only been working for as long as there have been interest rates that anybody's kept track of since the mid-1700s. So it's a pretty durable cycle.
Yeah, because when you look at interest rates, and I don't think people realize how quickly when interest rates are this low, you can lose money. I mean, if we look at, what was it, just a couple of weeks ago, the Treasury issued a 30-year bond at a record low rate of 2.17. As I recollect now, that rate is much higher. We had the 10-year Treasury note get down to like 1.36. It's now closer over 1.5. People don't realize how quickly you can lose money in the bond market when you have interest rates this low.
Yeah, you can lose an entire year's interest on one bad day.
Just one day.
Yep, on one bad day of price action. People talk about flight to safety or flight to quality going into bonds. That's not what I like to call quality.
You know, explain to our listeners and give me your perspective on this, because we get emails about one third of sovereign debt out there. I think the figure is close to $13 trillion actually has a negative interest rate. So you loan the government money and the government charges you interest to loan them money. And people say, who would buy this? Who would ever put their money? I mean, we saw in Japan in February when they implemented negative interest rates, there was a run on safes. People are keeping their money in the mattress. They're buying gold. So I assume the people that are buying these government bonds are large corporations, central banks, or institutions that have no place to park trillions of dollars of money.
And some of the insurance companies are required to buy that type of debt. It's just madness. It's silliness, and it's the current version of a bubble, and it's not going to end well because bubbles never end well. I don't have an answer for what any central bank ought to do about that problem, but I do know that I wouldn't want to be in bond-related investments for the next 10 years, or for the next 25 years, really, other than as a trading opportunity from moment to moment.
So if bonds are not going to be a good investment, and I agree with you, I think the 35-year bond bull market is coming to an end. I mean, I just don't see everybody keeping their money in the bank at negative interest rates, as shown in Japan when people start buying safes and putting their money in mattresses. Then what asset class does well in this environment? Are we heading for more of an inflationary environment, much like we had in the 70s. Maybe we won't get to 14% inflation rate, but would it imply, Tom, that risk assets or tangible assets or stocks are going to be the better place to be if bonds are going to be the place not to be?
Well, I don't have a good answer for the next 10 years, Jim, but I can tell you about the next 3 months and say that probably all of those assets that you're talking about are not going to have a good period for the next 3 months. One of the important tools that we use in our work is the presidential cycle pattern, which we calculate in the same way that you would calculate an annual seasonal pattern for the stock market, except that the season is 4 years long instead of 1 year long. And you chop up the data on the S&P 500 into four-year chunks, and then you average them together so you get an idea what the average pattern looks like. We go one step further because election years are different, and we're in an election year right now, in case nobody's heard. Election years are different depending on whether you have a first-term president who's an incumbent running for re-election, or instead you have the condition like we have now where there's two new challengers and the incumbent is not running. Under that latter condition, the months leading up to the election tend to be much more negative. There's a peak in July, and I think we've just had it. There's another little peak in August, and then we start downward in earnest as the airwaves are bombarded by political commercials and everybody's starting to worry and panic about what the election means. And investors tend to not like unknown risks. And so right now, we don't know who's going to get elected and what they're going to do. And the market might be able to handle either possibility. It doesn't like not knowing. And so as we head into October, or about whenever the outcome of the election is going to become certain enough to the market, I see a downward period, not a huge down period, but not an up period. And I say it's not a huge down period because we just recently had a new record all-time high for the New York Stock Exchange advanced decline line. That's counting up the number of stocks going up every day versus going down and tabulating that on a daily basis. And studies that we've done going back 60 years, when you have a new all-time high or a new even three-year high for the advanced decline line, you are immunized to some extent over the next 3 months from having a significant decline. So yes, you can have a normal 5 to 10% drop, a garden variety correction, but you're somewhat immunized against having the real ugly bear markets. So I'm not looking for a terrible ugly bear market going into the election, but I'm not looking for a good positive time either.
There's a lot of speculation. The Fed met this week. They didn't do anything, but they implied that things are improving. So speculation is increasing that perhaps they go as soon as September. But Tom, for life of me, and I may be wrong, who knows what the Fed's going to do, I just don't see them raising interest rates 2 months before a presidential election, given the fact that Yellen is also a Democrat, but also the fact that the Fed raised interest rates a quarter of a point in December last year, and look what happened the first 6 weeks of this year. So I don't think these guys can be very confident if they raise interest rates a quarter of a point that the markets won't react severely. When everybody is betting that they don't, if they do, you know what happens? Those bets get reversed and you get violent actions in the market.
You've said it very well. I don't have anything to add. It's exactly right.
So given this fact that my own estimation that they probably refrain to do anything, the futures market says if they go any time this year, it'll probably be December after the election's over. So as we get into this presidential cycle, you got the polls going now. They were doing this interview. It would be the last day of the Democratic convention. Last week we had the Republican. When do you see cyclically in the markets the impact of this presidential cycle become more pronounced? Is it in September, 2 months before, when the markets really start watching the polls, which way the country is leaning? Because obviously there's a difference in the policies proposed by each party. Is it September leading up to the elections that the market begins to pay more attention?
Yes, it should start drifting down now, but the meat of the decline, of whatever decline we're going to get leading up to the election, should be in September and the first couple of weeks of October. By mid-October, I expect that the fear and the panic will have reached a climax. The reasons for it may not have reached a climax or may not have reached resolution, but the effect on the stock market will reach its climax probably by mid-October. And then after mid-October, I'm actually fairly bullish going into early 2017. I think that investors are just going to get themselves all worked up into a lather over what the election means and what's going to happen, and they're going to overdo it, and then there's going to be a little bit of relief going into early 2017. So I'm really looking forward to a great buying opportunity in October, but not right now.
So right now, if you were looking at the market, you might say raise some cash, wait on the sidelines, wait for this thing to play out. And then when fear is most pronounced, a good example is the first day of Brexit. Following Brexit that Friday, where the Dow lost 600 points, we lost 1,000 points in 2 days of trading. So once we get to that point, then you think it's going to be a nice time to get in. So we get a nice year-end rally or a Santa Claus rally. What about 2017? And let's talk about the first year of a presidential election cycle. What does your cycle work tell you about that? And let's talk about 2017.
The good times of that rally out of October will probably last only until about Inauguration Day. When you get a new president coming in, and I've orbited the sun now over 50 times, and I've seen it in every election cycle. When you get a brand new president, especially from a new party, coming into office, typically what happens in the first few weeks of the new presidential term is that the new president discovers that, oh my gosh, things are even worse than I told you they were during the campaign, and that the only solution is whatever, you know, package of plans or tax hikes or tax cuts or spending that the president is proposing to get through Congress. They all seem to do this. They all realize, oh my gosh, it's much more horrible than I said, and investors tend not to like hearing that things are worse than they thought. And that tends to bum everybody out, and they start to sell their stocks again. So Inauguration Day could be a good selling day off of this rally out of the October low. But we'll worry about what to do in January when January gets a little bit closer. But the basic point, though, is that when you start hearing that next year in 2017, when either Clinton or Trump starts telling us that things are even worse than I told you before and that the only solution is whatever, remember that you heard it here first, and remember that this is extremely normal for all new presidents to do.
So let's talk about another asset class that has been one of the star performers this year in up until recently, even energy. Let's talk about the commodity complex and what's going on there. What do you see in gold and oil?
Well, we talked about the oil glut right now, and the oil glut is being furthered by the infusion of a bunch of new money that's coming in that didn't want to invest in the oil patch at 25, but now that it's been at 50, they decided that they wanted to invest. Well, now suddenly it's dropped to 42, and they have already committed to that investment, so there's going to be more drilling and more supply coming online. I think we're going to be in low oil prices for quite a while. Gold prices are in a cyclical decline that's part of two different cycles that are dominant in the gold market. There is a 13.5-month cycle, which is due to bottom in October of this year, plus or minus a month. It's not as punctual as I wish it was, but ideally it's due to bottom in October, so sometime this fall, between September and November, even December, is when we should expect that. There's also a really dominant 8-year cycle in gold. They're two independent cycles, but they both operate. And that 8-year cycle has been working ever since gold became freely traded in the 1970s. It wasn't as easy to detect when we only had a couple of iterations of it, but now that we've seen 4 or 5 independent cycles since then, we can see that about every 8 years you get a major bottom. Well, that major 8-year bottom is due to arrive sometime between about August this year and March of next year. I expect those two cycles to come together and align and synchronize their bottoms, ideally in October of this year, plus or minus a little bit, and we'll try to focus in on it in our newsletter exactly when that bottom is arriving. But between now and then, I expect gold prices to decline. And coincidentally, so do the commercial traders whose positions get listed in the Commitment of Traders report. They are hugely net short gold. They are at, I think it's an 8-year high in terms of their net short position in silver right now. So the smart money is betting on gold and silver prices coming down in the next few weeks, and I'm betting with them on that happening.
So these cycles are coming together, but if you look at the longer-term picture for gold, would you say it is in a bull market, it's going to resume that bull market, or will this be a shorter cycle?
For the long term, coming out of this big 8-year bottom is due sometime at the end of this year, I expect huge gains in gold. The initial phase of the new 8-year cycle has been the best time to buy gold and own gold. So we're getting two important cycles, the 13.5-month and the 8-year, both turning upward sometime at the end of this year. And the initial phases of the upward phase of the new cycle is really a great time to own gold. So coming out of wherever that bottom is, ideally in October, but don't chisel that into stone, wherever that bottom is, I'm expecting a great new bull market in gold. And I think that all the money printing that's been going on for all this time is finally going to get some traction and really push gold prices higher. But this is not the moment in July to try to get ready for that yet. There's time to wait and let gold prices come down to a more attractive level.
So when you take a look at the overall market right now, you sense weakness in all major categories, probably leading up into that September-October low, but then a nice rally into the end of the year and probably the beginning of next year until the new president takes office.
That's correct. So I'm looking at really all of the major assets going down in price together, which is unusual. We're used to stocks and bonds doing opposite things. I think they're all going to come down together as everybody gets worried and they start to think cash is a really good idea and they start buying safes or they put it in the bank of Sealy or Therma-Pedic, put it under the mattress. But then I think that that mood will shift and people will start wanting to put money to work and really push asset prices up higher once they start to think that the outcome of the election is becoming clear. And that'll usually be before the actual election. The market figures out ahead of time what's going to be the case, and it starts moving. So if you're waiting for the first Tuesday in November or reading the election results on the Wednesday afterward, you may be missing the exact moment when the market has already made up its mind.
I'm not a technician, but I always know the markets pay a lot more attention when you get to September and October, because then all of a sudden the market is saying, all right, we got two candidates and they both have different things they want to do. And so they start following the polls and seeing which direction is going, but it's creating uncertainty. What is it about September and October that always tend to be problems?
That's a great question. And the best answer was from a Stanford University psychologist who I heard talking once. He talked about suicide studies in Europe, you know, especially in Norway and Finland, you know, really northern latitude people where the length of the day varies by quite a bit. And he said that among those people, there are two peaks, two annualized peaks in suicides. One is in January, which makes sense because the Christmas holiday is over and it's really dark all the time. And you're really depressed because it's so dark and it's just really dark. And so people commit suicide in January. But the other peak is in September. And you think, well, why? But the answer is that the length of the day changes at the fastest rate in September. And so the human mind, which, you know, through eons of evolution, it knows that you have growing times and you have hoarding times and you got to pull your nuts into the cave and to live off during the winter. You're feeling that the most with the shrinking length of the day, the most in September. And so there's a suicide peak in those northern countries there. You don't see the same sorts of peaks in equatorial countries where they don't perceive the length of the day difference as much. It's much more pronounced in the very northern latitude. So I expect that it's the same human psychology that's at work as we contemplate our investments in September and we're perceiving that length of the day change and we want to pull in and we want to hoard cash and we want to avoid risk because we're sensing the change in the season. Isn't that a fascinating concept?
Yeah, it really is. But, you know, I've always wondered what it is, because we know whether it bottoms in September or October, either of those 2 months, it seems like every single fall you can expect turbulence in the markets around that time.
And it's also magnified by traders who have kids, and they take some time off in August to go to the shore, and then they come back and are ready to work in September because the kids are in school, so they might as well start paying attention again. So I think that is a magnifying force, not a driving force.
Let me just throw one more question at you, Tom, and I'm just curious to get your views on this. If we assume at this point that the 35-year bull market in bonds is over, could money coming out of the bond market, like it did in the late 70s, especially between 1977 and 1981, when interest rates rose and hit a peak, because they were in a trading range for pretty much 6 or 7 years in the 70s, between 6% and 8%, then they spiked all the way to 15. Could you see a rush out of bonds when people start realizing, I could lose money in bonds, and that money moves into other type of assets?
Yes, I can foresee that, but the event you're describing from the late 1970s, that was leading up to the 60-year cycle peak, which was in 1980. So the 60-year cycle peak, the next one is due in 2040. We've got some time to get ready for that. I think that the dawning realization that you're talking about will happen much more slowly. But having said that, if you're a young person in your 20s as part of the echo boom generation, you know, the children of the baby boomers, and you're still just renting and you're not quite ready to buy a house, you're going to be behind the wave of rising real estate prices as all the rest of your generation starts wanting to buy a house. And you're going to miss out on the really ridiculously low mortgage rates that the banks are offering you right now. So the best way to short bonds for the next 30 years is to have a mortgage, because effectively that's what you're doing, is you're shorting bonds and you're taking advantage of the high price, low yield, and locking it in for as long as you can.
I couldn't agree more. I would have never thought, and Tom, I don't know what you ever would have ever thought in your lifetime, that we would see mortgage rates. I mean, at this point, you can get a 15-year mortgage at 2.75%. You can get a 30-year mortgage at 3.5%. And unlike the housing boom in the last decade, where people got these teaser rates to get you in on a mortgage, and then eventually they went up, these are real long-term rates that you can lock into for 15 and 30 years. So I agree with you 100%. Well, listen, Tom, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, how could they do so?
Well, come to our website. It's mcoscillator.com and check out the free Learning Center articles that we have there. You can sign up for our free weekly chart and focus article. We also have paid subscription products. We have a twice monthly newsletter and we have a daily edition. I'm also on Twitter at McClellanOSC, A-O-S-C, at McClellanOSC, and you can follow my periodic postings there. But come take a look at our website.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense News Hour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
Joining us on the show today is David Marsh. He is the co-founder and managing director of the Official Monetary and Financial Institutions Forum, also known as the OMFIF. And he's also the author of Europe's Deadlock. David, when we last spoke to you, you had explained that according to your analysis, we are seeing central banks worldwide investing in equities. If you wouldn't mind, give our listeners some background on the 2016 Global Public Investor Report and touch upon some of the themes that we discussed earlier.
The move into equities has continued, and now there's more central banks all over the world investing relatively routinely, still quite small amounts of money in equities, but they are also moving into areas like corporate bonds, real estate and infrastructure, which are pretty illiquid instruments. So we see continuation of themes that we saw already in 2014 and 2015 accentuated last year, particularly because of the fact that reserves overall are coming under more pressure as a result of these changes in the world economy.
I want to ask you about the report in general. Can you give our audience a bit of background on some of the numbers that you look at and who exactly you're analyzing?
So we surveyed 500 investment institutions, central banks, sovereign funds, and public pension funds. And the assets under management are still just slightly smaller than $30 trillion. So it's a huge compendium of different facts and figures about all these public sector investment institutions, which are increasingly becoming real generators of asset management behavior on world capital markets. And behind that, great influences in many, many ways on the world economy.
Well, one of the best performers this year has been the gold market and especially gold stocks. Recently, gold has been pulling back in a correction. Is this just a correction before it launches to higher levels? Let's find out about that. Joining us on the program is Frank Combs from U.S. Global. Frank, let's talk about the gold market after hitting a low in February. Gold has just been on a tear, especially the gold stocks. I mean, you know, I'm looking at my Bloomberg screen. Some of these stocks are up a couple 100% this year. So let's take a look at what's driving this right now. Can gold go higher? And what about the summer doldrums? Because typically in the summer, it's been a weak time historically for gold. Let's talk about where gold is today.
Well, I've mentioned, I've written before, and I've been on your program, and I've tried to simplify what drives gold on a big picture. And there's two drivers in simple terms, the fear trade and the love trade. The love trade has to do with rising GDP per capita in emerging economies in Asia and the Middle East. And the fear trade, which sort of dominates the psychic of Americans and North Americans in particular, Canadians and Europeans, is the fear trade. And the drivers there are two factors, money supply growth and negative real interest rates. And the biggest single factor is negative real interest rates. And what does that mean? It basically says, what will the government pay you, the investor, or it could be an individual investor, or it could be a pension fund, what will they pay you? Let's say they're going to pay you 1% for 5 years.
you deduct this monthly CPI number. And if the inflation rate is running at 1%, they're paying you nothing. So that is a key factor, what they call real interest rates. So the government should be paying you a positive real rate of return above the monthly CPI number. And any time that real rates go negative in a country's currency, the price of gold starts to rocket and take off in that country's currency. And if you go back in the history to 2011, when gold hit 1900, the 10-year U.S. government bond, if you bought it in September of 2011, I believe that you were locking in a minus 3% yield. You're going to lose 3% a year for 10 years against the inflationary rate, what they're going to pay you. And that's why gold rocketed to 1900. Now, we all got fooled because Fed funds didn't change, but real interest rates in the U.S. did, because the CPI number fell dramatically and the rate started to rise in the 10-year government bond, and real interest rates went from minus 3% for 10-year government bonds to plus 2% a year ago. So anytime you've got a 500 basis points rise in real interest rates, that country's currency is very strong. And the dollar, therefore, was very strong. We did not see this happen in Europe or Asia or Latin America, but we did see it in America. So one another way of looking at that, and we published this last week, is that a year ago, there was approximately $1 trillion of government sovereign bonds outstanding with negative yields. Today, it's $9 trillion. Well, it's gone up nine times. So the world has gone to negative interest rates, and the U.S. is now going to, when you look at two-year and five-year government bonds, they're going to negative real interest rates, and gold starts this incredible march to become much more attractive as a safe asset class. And I think the fact is that gold is the fourth most liquid asset class in the world. And gold has always been that sort of safe haven that I find it amazing that so many writers on Wall Street hate gold, but the Federal Reserve doesn't like to keep other countries' currencies. They keep gold.
So when we take a look at, we have these two opposite, it reminds me like the risk on and the risk off trade, Frank. You have the fear on and the love trade. So there's two different aspects of it. Now let's talk about the stocks, which have done, I mean, some of the returns on the gold stocks have been spectacular. Explain for our listeners, because you manage a gold fund, how small the market cap is, capitalization. I mean, if you were to take the entire gold industry, the stock market value of all these stocks, from Barrick to Newmont to the big guys to the little guys, it doesn't even add up to the market cap of a Coca-Cola. So when money comes into the sector, there's so little to choose from, or the sector is so small that it doesn't take a lot of money to drive these stocks. Explain that, because you manage a gold fund, so you see it.
We do. And then what happened, too, is that during that process from 2011 down to last year, is that the gold mining companies had to start streamlining and cutting back. And what we've witnessed is massive deflation. Mining equipment started to fall, the prices, cutbacks in exploration and development. And so I think that this is a very important part for investors to recognize, is that many of these companies started streamlining themselves, and they were able to get their costs down. So their costs were pushing $1,700 an ounce gold, and now they've been able to get those costs down to $800 an ounce gold. So now they're more profitable. So right at the bottom of the gold cycle, basically happened in December of 2015, was that pivot point that gold slowly starts to rise, and the gold mining companies have really changed, a lot of change in management. Senior management has become much more concerned about returns on invested capital. They didn't care about that 5 years ago, 10 years ago. All they cared about was growth, growth, growth. They didn't care about dilution of shareholders. Today, they're much more focused on that return on invested capital on a per share basis, on protecting the reserves per share, protecting the production per share. So if they're going to do M&A work, is it really going to be accretive on a per share basis? That psychological change has benefited the gold stocks. So this is the first time, you know, it's interesting you bring this up, from 2001 until 2007, gold stocks far, far outperformed bullion. And after 2008, even though gold ran to 1900, bullion far outperformed the gold stocks because none of the gold stocks were showing growth in that cash flow. Today, we're seeing gold rise, but we're seeing huge changes in the cash flow for many of these gold mining companies. So when you look at the global picture of 88 gold producers we track, South African rand has collapsed, just like back in 2001. Well, that was the best performing gold stocks, and our fund was up 130% that year. So now you're seeing that last year, even though gold was down 10%, the currency was off 40%. The price of oil, which is an important ingredient for cost structure, it had fallen more than 40%. So they had this huge margin expansion, and these stocks jumped 200%. The other place you saw this was in Australia, where price of oil fell, the currency fell dramatically, and you saw therefore that they were getting U.S. dollars, and they're having huge margin expansion. So margin expansion this year is really showing up because their currencies still remain relatively weak. The price of gold is appreciated 25%, and the price of oil has barely come off the bottom on a relative basis, so it's not had any dent in any cost compression. So these gold stocks have been ripping.
So, Frank, when you take a look at this market, you said a couple of things have changed. The bear market that we saw for a couple of years forced these companies to start looking at cost structure and also change management and become more shareholder friendly, because they certainly weren't that way in the last decade. Some of the deals that were done, the compensation structure, the dilution to shareholders. Now, let's talk about the future. As the market improved in the last decade, the structure of companies changed. Management went after growth at any cost. Some of the deals that they did, you almost had to question the price that they were paying for gold in the ground. What's not to say that that would happen again if indeed gold continues to go higher?
Well, I think that there's just a discipline. It's like the airlines industry. After you've gone through so much pain of restructuring and bankruptcies, and you have a change in senior management, a change that returns on shareholders' investment capital becomes a more significant factor. I think that's really important in the stewardship, and boards of directors are becoming much more forceful and management focused on those returns on a per share basis.
So when you meet with management of these companies, as you guys are considering making a substantial investment in a gold mining company, what are the questions that you ask them?
Their decision process on a per share basis. Do they really focus on what they're doing on a per share basis? Or are they growth for the sake of growth? And when they go make an acquisition, what's their model to show it's truly accretive?
So when you're looking at these companies, you want to see that they're making good business decisions. Let's talk about the long-term drivers. As you mentioned, as we started this conversation, it was negative interest rates. Frank, on the day you and I are speaking, U.S. GDP for the second quarter was 1.2%. GDP in Canada actually contracted. European growth has slowed down. What that tells me, central banks aren't in a hurry to raise interest rates anytime soon. In fact, the trend has been to keep rates lower, more quantitative easing. They're talking about helicopter drops possibly coming to Japan. Japan is considering issuing a 50-year bond. So it looks like the fundamentals, these negative interest rates, are going to be there for a while. And I wonder if you might want to talk about the individual contribution, let's say the individual investor, because when the Japanese Central Bank started negative interest rates in February, there was a run on safes in Japan. The Japanese citizen said, I'm not going to keep my money in the bank and pay them interest. I'll keep it in my mattress. And also, Japanese started buying gold. Are you seeing that as a trend that is universal, or is that particular to a country like Japan?
It's nothing significant yet. It really is. It's nothing that otherwise I think gold would propel much higher. I also think that we're going to see the opportunities is the senior mining companies are going to acquire companies. There's this whole theory on peak gold and keep peak gold supply. And I think that has much more credence unless you get technology coming in like it did the energy space with fracking and change the supply factor. I think you're going to see, based on the billions of dollars spent in the past 10 years looking for gold, there's very few mega projects been discovered. And those projects that are decent and attractive, they've been filled with delays and disappointments by government moving the goalposts with taxes and environmentalists coming in and being disruptive for that production to come on side. And it doesn't matter what the standards of care are, there's just this anti-mining. So I think that supply side is going to be a factor to propel gold higher. So the fear element, will people be buying it, but there's also this supply. And I think, therefore, these big mining companies are going to have to grow. They're going to have to go and acquire these mid-cap gold stocks. And I think that as a mid-cap gold stock, it gets very close to expanding its production or is in production and it's not trading at an attractive P/E ratio, I think this is going to be gobbled up. And I think a lot of opportunities in the next 2 years are going to be in the mid-cap gold producers. And then the big cap, it's going to be the royalty companies. It's interesting that Glencore has been a great stock picker this year, but Glencore in December wasn't able to raise money. It was basically Franco-Nevada that could raise $1 billion in 24 hours, and then they turned around and bought the royalties from Glencore. So I think that that's how this market's going to shape itself. But I'll come back to what I've always said, 10% weighting in gold and gold shares and rebalancing each year. And if you're more active, rebalance this 10% every quarter, and you catch these great runs in gold and gold stocks.
Frank, let's talk about the gold sector, and you mentioned peak gold. There was the same thing that happened in the energy industry, and especially in the last decade with the run-up of oil back in 2008 when oil prices got up to 150. So there was this talk, a lot of talk. I was an adherent to peak oil. And then all of a sudden, we had two technologies come on board. We had horizontal drilling and fracking, and then we had shale oil discovery, and all of a sudden, the U.S., which was only producing a little over 5 million barrels a day, became the most significant factor in the energy market by increasing its production by 4 million barrels. Is there anything like that in the gold industry, technology-wise, or is there a company working on this technology that could change an existing gold field where the companies can get and extract more gold? Is there anything like that in the gold sector?
No, nothing. You know, the big breakthrough that took place, increase in supply 30 years ago, was heap leaching, and that was a significant breakthrough, but there's been nothing that's out there that allows you to defy Mother Nature. And also, it's the ramp up in regulations. And this also is another factor. And I think that this is a real important part when people want to ask, why can we have zero interest rates? The Swiss went to a 50-year bond, has negative interest rates. 50-year Swiss bond. Well, how could that happen? And I think it's regulations. I think that when you look at some research that came out that said that Americans 8 years ago were spending 7 billion hours a year filling out forms, and now it's 10 billion a year of hours just filling out forms. So you think of corporations. We've seen what Frank Dodd has done to the collateral cost to us, anti-money laundering laws, which were originally to go after drug lords and Al-Qaeda of the world, basically said, no, all citizens are guilty until they prove their innocence. The burden and cost of that, it's just in my sector, I hear about environmental has been a big factor. So I think when you look at what the Brexit took place, the why the British left the EU, is that you had policymakers, socialistic policymakers, idealists in Brussels, that started dictating every aspect of their lives of the Brits. And a classic was, if a British farmer didn't have a 9-inch cucumber, then it wasn't grade A and he couldn't sell it. And if you were a shopkeeper and you're selling bananas in England and it had too much of a curve on that, the banana, then it wasn't grade A. All of a sudden, for the Spanish and the Italians, you had these people in Brussels dictating this, 100,000 rules for making a pillow or a mattress. So this is the reason why you have to have low interest rates, because all the benefits of these low interest rates are being usurped away, clawed back by either taxation rising or regulations, which is an indirect form of taxation. And so I think the Brits finally got fed up with this. And there's some great video clips on it. BBC did a special on it 6 months ago. And, you know, why were the citizens upset? And I think that it's very important. Everyone, I remember having debates on this in Asia, and that Brexit was actually going to be good because it was basically what created America. No representation with taxation doesn't fly. And what the Brits got fed up with was taxation and regulation and no representation. These policy bankers were making more than President Obama, more than Prime Minister Cameron. And so I think these are the positive parts that are for the global economy, and maybe they'll start deregulating or streamlining regulations. Then rates would get back to normal. That would be a game changer. But I don't see it in the cards right now. So I see it on steroids, these rules and regulations by every one of the agencies of our own domestic government and other governments around the world. So that means that rates are going to stay negative and gold is going to trade higher.
Yeah, it's interesting because we've been following, because we think helicopter drops are coming next to the United States. And I followed the Republican convention, read their platform, followed the Democratic convention and read their platform. When I got in this business, it was taxes and inflation. Now it's taxes and regulation. And after watching the Democratic convention, Frank, there's more regulation. I mean, they're talking about even a tax on securities, more control over government. So you've got these competing philosophies, but it's a clarion call coming from the major parties that we need to regulate more. And yet they don't understand, like on the day you and I are speaking, second quarter GDP growth came in at 1.2%.
Yeah. Absolutely. More tariffs, more taxation. So there are tariffs on the steel dump, and then they don't look at the impact it has on the car manufacturers, the benefits to you as a consumer. No, no, we have to pay higher steel prices for American steel, than which is in the global economy. And how does that benefit? Who does it benefit? You know, it's ongoing. We see this in the capital markets. I think another great point I realized that I wrote about a week ago was this whole attack by the socialist mindset of more taxation on the rich, because the ratio between the top 1% and the top 10% and the bottom 1% and the bottom 10% is too great in America. But when you look at performance of private equity funds and venture capital, they've had a CAGR between 11 and 12% for the past decade. And you look at the markets and it's plus 4%. But guess what? Only pension funds, institutions, and accredited investors are able to participate in these better performing asset classes. So therefore, the rules and regulations turn around and benefit the top 1%. And then they want to tax them more, but all the rules just are actually benefiting them. And I'll give you a classic with Sarbanes-Oxley came out. We used to do 100 IPOs a quarter in America. Now we do 25 a quarter. The average transaction IPO was $88 million. Now it's $270 million to bear the cost. But that valuation lift of you having the opportunity of coming in and buying a new consumer product company or a technology company, a healthcare company, doesn't matter, for an $88 million value IPO and running to $260 million, that was your capital gain. But that's taken away because the cost of Sarbanes-Oxley is so great. So this is where the rules and regulations are impacting this. And I think we're going to also see in the big picture is these low interest rates is having a significant impact on people like CalPERS. They've had terrible returns because of low bond yields. And I think there's going to be a rush to dividend paying stocks. Now, the Federal Reserve can't do it like they can in other countries, but Japan and Switzerland own more than 15% of their stocks. And in particular, they're able to go and float paper at negative rates of return, and they go buy their companies that are paying dividends, and they get a positive rate of return. So I think that we're going to see this rush into equities where there's sustainable dividend paying, that those yields are going to fall down to where 5 and 10 year government bonds are. And I think that that's what's propelling the stock market higher with all this sort of negative GDP number data.
Couldn't agree more, Frank. Well, listen, given where gold is now in the correction that we've seen in the stocks, I know you're a proponent, and I'm glad to hear you say this, because a lot of people tend to get carried away in one sector. There are a lot of people will put 20, 30. I've seen people put 50, 60% in gold, and you've always recommended 10%, no more. If it gets over that, you rebalance, reallocate, go into something else. Would you be buying stocks or gold here, or do you think this correction has a ways to play?
Well, I think you had the opportunity of taking that correction, say, at June 30th. You had a great win, and you were able to buy stocks and rebalance there and bonds. One of the things of a product we have is called Near Term, and it's a short-term muni. And what's interesting is that foreigners are now buying munis in America because they're government-rated, and there's positive rates of return. They don't get tax benefits, but those yields are still so attractive. So I think the idea of buying those, that rebalancing includes both equities and includes short-term munis, is very, very prudent And we've done regressional analysis of showing this idea that you had, say, 90% Nerex and you had 10% gold, that your volatility dropped dramatically and you positively have a positive returns over the past 10 years. And I think that that's important to look at in this diversification.
All right, Frank. Well, listen, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow the work that you do at U.S. Global and read the things you write about, how can they do so, please?
USFunds.com, USFunds.com, and sign up for the Investor Alert and Frank Talk. We publish every Friday. We do a SWOT analysis of the different asset classes. It's succinct. It's always three strengths, three weaknesses of last week, and like pro athletes looking for next week's game, what economic data points are coming out next week that could be an opportunity or a threat to those different asset classes. And for your listeners, next week, PMI is going to be an important factor because it's a forward-looking index of factors that looks at the future, and copper and oil and gas are highly correlated to what PMI trends are.
If you've been watching the Republican-Democratic conventions, you'll notice that between what was said by the two candidates, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, there seems to be a disconnect between the things they're promising people and what it is we're actually going to be able to deliver given the places that we are headed right now, because we here on the show are looking at the next financial crisis, and it's all one giant confidence game geared to keep everybody thinking that everything's flowing along just fine. But it isn't, and it won't be. We've had incredibly anemic economic growth, and the Fed's projections never seem to pan out. That's the first subject of conversation coming up next on The Big Picture, the next financial crisis, the confidence game. And you know, we'll be moving very shortly, most likely, from deflation to inflation. We've been in a disinflationary, as they call it, environment for 35 years, but those trends don't last forever. And central banks are talking about lots of helicopter drops, meaning monetary inflation. So what does all this mean for investors? I mean, how do you play this all out with risk on, risk off, risk everywhere? That'll be the second topic of conversation coming up today on The Big Picture as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.